Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It is Friday. So we tend to head for the bright side of the road.
To the bright side of the road.
Van Morris hanging out there. It's Van Morrison hanging out there already. And joining me is a fan of Van Morrison and officially the All Marine Radio head chef, Kim Holmes. Kim, good morning. How are you?
Top of the morning.
All right, man. You're how's life? You, everything all right? Anything exciting going on?
Nah, just dodging rain right now.
Oh, really?
But it's in the 60s, 70s. So it's nice, you know. It's so nice.
What about
everything's green. I'm in shorts all the time now, and I just love it. I love it. It's real beautiful here in the, as you know, when the leaves are out and everything's green. The dirt is jet black, and the leaves are bright green. It's a real pretty scene.
You know, I made a trip to Yuma on last Sunday. I drove over on Sunday, and I drove back on Monday. And the trip, from where I am in Orange County, you drive down the coast to San Diego, and then you head east. And when you head east out of San Diego, you're driving kind of along the southern border. And in fact, there's stretches where you can
Interstate 10.
Interstate 8. 10 is
10's above it. Yeah, right, 10 goes through Phoenix.
Yeah, Flagstaff,
Eight
Phoenix.
8 goes through Yuma.
Yuma.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it was a beautiful drive. And you talk about green. I've never seen this part of the country as green as it is now, as it is now after all the rain and following the rain, very moderate temperatures. So the drive to Yuma let me tell you, it's normally beautiful. It's mountains, and then you drop out of the mountains into the flat desert. And that is spectacular too, on the eastern side of California, the western side of Arizona. And just the mountains you do see in the desert, it's beautiful. But I've never seen it as pretty and green as it was this last week when I drove it out there and then back. So I'm with you, man. It's a little bit different this year. The weather certainly is.
Little do people know, when the desert gets rain, it comes alive.
Oh, man.
The wildflowers, flowers, greenery everywhere. It's gorgeous. The desert, when after a couple of days of rain, it's a different world.
Yeah, and normally
it's quite beautiful. You got lucky.
Yeah, normally the hot weather doesn't allow it to stay like that. Normally the hot weather will kill it.
No,
you know, in relatively short order. But as Kim said, you know, you see some things in the beautiful things in the desert when you're going through it. If the weather has changed, take your breath away. And the other thing you're reminded of is, first of all, the country's so big and so beautiful. And when you have a chance to drive it, which is one of my favorite things to do, people say, "Well, why don't you just fly? You know, fly to Phoenix and then rent a car." I'm like, look, when you start adding up the hours. It's a 3.5-hour drive going 85 miles an hour to Yuma. Okay? So I got to get to the airport an hour early. So I got to start getting ready an hour and a half before that. So start adding the hours. So then it's an hour flight over to Phoenix, and then another hour drive. It's faster to drive the thing. Oh, didn't think about
it. It's faster. It's more beautiful. You have your own tunes. You don't have a plane full of people dressed in gym clothes that smell.
Well, come on,
airplane
man.
Travel right now is not like it used to be. That's all I'm saying.
It used to be
what it is, man.
It used to be a little,
I agree.
It used to be a little fancier, and you could smoke cigarettes.
Well, yeah, you could smoke in certain sections of the planes.
Yeah, because you know, in the back
of the plane.
You know how that smoke goes. It stays back there.
Yeah, yeah, right. As it goes into the circulation unit and comes out the front of the airplane,
so we can share the first cabin. We can share it with everybody.
Everybody.
Right.
No, I like the fact that there's no smoking. It's just, you know, the planes have shrunk and the seat size has shrunk.
Yeah.
Their aisles are getting narrower.
Yeah.
And everybody brings on carry-on luggage.
Oh my God!
So
my favorite is when you're trying to get off. When you're trying to get off, and the little old ladies who bring on their big carry-on, the biggest carry-on they can bring, and it's in the overhead, and they're pulling that thing out. And you say, "Do you need help?" And they say, "No, it's okay." And you're like, "Somebody could get hit in the head and killed here." it's a shit show. So
no. They say, "Can you help?" And, "Oh, yes, Sonny, thank you very much." In the first place, it's so heavy, you had to have somebody help them put it up there,
right,
let alone get it down.
Right.
It's all a plot.
Well, let me just tell you, one of the things that really pisses me off in the world is the fact that, is it too much to ask, like, when you see people stand moving three aisles in front of you, you know, three rows in front of you, that you get up and grab your bag so you're ready just to walk off? And the answer to that is yes. Because what happens is, you know, the row in front of you empties. Now you stand up, you stand in the aisle, you get your bag down, and then you grab your coat, and then you grab your pack, and then you walk off. Like, you do this. It just, that's what I think.
Every time.
Oh, my God. You land, and if you're two-thirds of the way in the back of the plane, it's going to be another 20 minutes before you get off, the son of a bitch. There's a business for Marines around the country, and I should organize it and implement it, right? As soon as you pull up to the gate, you hear the intercom come on. All right, everybody, listen up. Stand the fuck up right now. All right. Everybody, get those bags down. Right? Big people, tall people, help little people. Do it now. So you give them 60 seconds. Right? All the bags come down. All right. Stand by. Everybody face forward. Door opens.
Yeah.
Move.
And put your shoes back on.
Oh, my God. Move! And when we say move, everybody's moving out. This thing's going to take us maybe 10 minutes to unload at the most. That, let me just tell you, let's talk about something that makes my blood boil. And I sit there now, and I'm better at it now.
That's another testimony to the fact that you drive places. I love driving places. I used to drive back and forth across the country. There's this company that you have that take people's cars and drive them across country that's gotten transferred.
Yes.
And it's called AAAA or something like that. And you put down a deposit of $50 and you pay for the gas and oil and you got the car to go coast to coast. You got 9 days to do it. Well, we'd load it up and camp on the way and it was so much fun and cheap. And now that I have my own car, I love driving. I love getting in that car and driving it. I don't care where.
Yeah.
Anywhere is fine.
And again, it's just the other thing it does is it reinforces how beautiful the country is. I mean, I'm not a big fan. Honestly, I said this the other day, but when I was talking about this drive, I'm not a big fan of driving on the East Coast. To me, because what you get is an interstate that's carved out of trees, and you look left and right, you see trees. When you get out to the eastern part of the western part of the East Coast, you know, up along the Appalachian Mountains, when the terrain opens up and you're not socked in by trees, or you're driving along the whatever the coast highway is between like Vermont, Maine, and all of that, that's beautiful too. But I don't like the bowling alley feeling. But when you get, you know, all the rest of the country, absolutely majestic to drive.
West of the Mississippi River, Mac.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. It is west of the Mississippi, and I don't care. I've driven from North Dakota down to Southern California. I've driven up the coast in California. I've driven the lower part of it. I have family up in Washington, so I've driven up there. If you've never driven the northern tier, right, Minnesota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and into eastern Washington, it is absolutely breathtaking. Absolutely. I mean, kind of the route Lewis and Clark took, you know.
Yes, it is.
You know, when they got into Montana. But it is absolutely, positively gorgeous. And then if you drop further down to the center part of the western part of the country where you drive essentially, you know, the plains and then the Rockies and then into the Sierra Nevadas and into California, it is absolutely beautiful. And then if you drive the southern part, which is normally 10, 8, really, really far south.
8, but, 10,
but,
and
but,
15.
But you drive Texas, and then you drive northern New Mexico, northern Arizona, which is the stuff of the Grand Canyon, which is the stuff of, like, you'll be driving through northern New Mexico, and you'll think you're in a 1950s Western about fighting Indians, where you expect to see on these great plateaus, you know, 1,000 Indians on horseback with their rifles or bows and arrows staring down, getting ready to kill you. I mean, because it's unbelievably breathtaking, and most of us have only seen it in movies. But yeah, the Western United States is absolutely spectacular.
And a little sidebar here, the national park system in our country, especially in the western part of the United States, is out of bounds beautiful. And you can buy a pass for your family that gets you in every park all summer long. It's not that expensive, and they have campgrounds, and the campgrounds aren't on top of each other like some of the places back east. Sometimes you can't even see the campers next to you, and they all have little fire grates where you can barbecue, cook out at night, and then you have to pay attention to putting your fire out and making sure it's dry, you know, cold to the touch. It's just spectacular. I love our country. It is so wonderful.
Yeah.
I wish everybody could drive around.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm a fan of, you know, I'm a fan of people say, how are you going to get there? Well, I'm going to drive. And they're like, what?
I'm going to drive.
Yeah. No.
Why? Aren't you? The question is, aren't you driving?
No, they can't. No, you know, again, I just kind of grew up. My mom, when, you know, my dad was in baseball, and corporal punishment Kathleen, man, she was a do-it-yourselfer, man. She was not afraid. And so she would load, we'd get out of school about this time of year, about the second or between the second and the third week of June, going to Catholic school here. And then we'd go back after Labor Day. And she would pack us all into our we had a white station wagon that we called the Good Ship Lollipop, right?
That's great.
We would sing that song, and then And then we had the Good Ship Lollipop gave out in 1965 when we drove from Sacramento to Dallas. She drove us there by herself. Or she might have had a teenage girl drive with us. I can't remember if that was a trip, but she drove us all over the country. She drove us to Alabama a couple times. She drove us to Texas, and we'd be in the car fighting our asses off. And she'd be smoking her Parliaments. But when the Good Ship Lollipop gave out, and then we got a maroon Bonneville. And
nice.
Now let me tell you what was key in 1965 about the maroon Bonneville was it had air conditioning.
Yes, it did.
In Dallas, Texas, which was important for the summer, but it might have been 1964 or 65. And the reason I say that, my memory is because there's one summer when, I think it was 1965, my dad managed, the Birmingham A's. But in 1965, Birmingham was a pretty violent place, so we didn't go. But, you know, wherever we go, it was my mom who would put us in the car. And she would drive us there, and we'd stay in hotels. I used to sleepwalk as a kid, and I remember sleeping in a hotel in Winnemucca, Nevada. In Winnemucca, Nevada, and I got up and I went in the bathroom, and I took the top of the toilet off, the porcelain top of the toilet, and I lifted it over my head. And I fired it into the bathtub, right, in sleepwalking.
Oh, no. Oh, Jesus, Mac.
Can you imagine the noise that made? Kathleen.
Oh, I can, yeah.
Kathleen got up and was ready to kick my ass, right? I woke up, and I was trying to climb up the wall of the bathroom, right? I was, like, putting... So, and my mom was shaking me, right? She was shaking me, and I woke up.
Trying to wake you up.
And I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. But, yeah, she used to do this shit on her own, right? No cell phones or anything like that. And me and my two sisters. And so off we go. So it was pretty crazy, pretty fun. But, no, I was traveling. And that's how we saw, you know, that's how we saw the country. I saw the country as a kid. You know, stopping in diners and things along, you know, things like old Route 66, and the interstate system had just been built in the 50s. It was kind of a new thing, but there were still the old highways that existed, and that's where you usually had to go to get food, because shit hadn't been built along the interstate. And those old highways still competed for money. So you'd cut over, you know, you'd have a map and you'd say, well, here's the road, but this is not, but there's no, the city's over there. So you'd get up there, you'd kind of taxi over to the old highway and you'd eat and then you'd come back to the interstate.
And usually the food was great.
those old diners. Yeah.
Couldn't beat it. When I hitchhiked back from San Francisco in 1969, I had to hop a freight in Reno, and this train started to move out of the yard. This was the same weekend the Woodstock was going on. It was August of 69, and so I jumped on this flat car. Just had
what?
Just a flat car that hauls pipes and things.
So you went,
but
straight,
there wasn't anything on it.
You
I
went
just
straight
there was,
up.
There were six. There were six of us, or six or seven of us, and you couldn't. Etiquette meant you had to go to the back of the line, and I was trying to hitchhike at midnight, and I just said, "Hell with it, I'm going to sleep." So I went off the side of the road. I woke up, and there were 15 people standing on the interstate. And I was about 100 yards off. And right near in Sparks, Nevada, beside Reno, there somebody said, "Hey, there's a freight train heading to Kansas City." Well, Kansas City is on US 50, and that would have dropped me off. And if I hitchhiked, got off there, and then hitchhiked into Cincinnati, I was about 25 miles from home, Hamilton, Ohio.
Wow!
So the train slows down in Winnemucca, and we are, it's hotter, it's 100 degrees, no cover, and we look back, and the train's going about 5 miles an hour through this freight yard, maybe a little faster, I don't know. But we said, look, there's an open boxcar, let's go jump in it, and if not, the interstate's right here, we'll just walk over if we can't get back on the train. So we jumped on the damn train, and it was a boxcar that was full of crushed, like refrigerator cardboard boxes, all flattened out. So we were deluxe accommodations.
And how far did you ride the freight train? That's like hobo style.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going to take it. I was going to get off in Salt Lake because that's where you pick up the interstate again. And so the train's coming in the morning, and I saw these lights, and I thought, oh, Jesus, this train's going too fast. I'm not jumping off here. And so I just settled back down, and somebody says, look, about an hour later, there's the Mormon Tabernacle. It's all lit up. And I said, that's fucking Salt Lake. Well, where was that? I think that was Provo. I almost jumped off in the wrong town, but for fear of getting run over by the train. So it slowed down in this rail yard, and I jumped off the train. The rest of the guys were going on to Kansas City. And I got chased out of the rail yard by detectives.
Right, the foreman, the detectives. They didn't mess around.
They beat you up back then.
Right, they would not. They did not play.
Took your money, everything you had on you. And so I got out of the yard just in the nick of time, and then I got a ride with these two college kids that were heading back to Chicago. And they picked me up going eastern side of Salt Lake, and got a ride all the way to Chicago with them. We just drove straight through.
Wow.
And then I stayed overnight at their house and took a shower, and they took me out the interstate and got a ride into New York City. Two rides into New York City. Yeah. Okay. I loved hitchhiking. I loved this country, seeing the sights.
Yeah.
It's
beautiful. It's beautiful. And let me tell you, God, when
Winnemucca, what a place.
Somebody sent me an email, Jesus, Matt, talk about the middle of nowhere. It still looks the same throughout that stretch.
Of course.
Yeah, because
it does.
There's no business to employ anybody. So where is Winnemucca? Winnemucca is about
dead center.
Dead center of the northern part of Nevada. It's right along Highway 80. Corporal Punishment Kathleen did drive very far that day. Now that I'm looking at it, what was her deal? She's probably tired. And so, my poor mom. Here's another email.
Well,
you threw the top of the toilet into the bathtub in the middle of the night? I would have beat the shit out of you. I know. Can you imagine? You're dead asleep, and the next thing you hear is that. Can you imagine? And that was like, it wasn't like the cheap ass shit they make now, right? That was like a serious boom. In the middle of the night. I got off easy that night.
Well, you sure did. I'll say.
We had car bingo that we played little, where you close those little windows when you saw something. And then we'd fight about who cheated over. You didn't see that. I saw that. No, I saw him too. So we'd fight about that shit, right? We fight about, like, if your leg came over the line and was touching my leg, we fought over who sat in the middle. We fought over who was going to ride in the front seat, right? And the windows were down, right? Driving. I don't know however fast Kathleen drove. However fast she drove, with the windows fucking down, right? And an AM radio, so you only had something to listen to rarely, right, in the western part of the United States.
Momentarily. You know, the only thing I could get consistently driving across country was back in the, driving in the 50s and 60s, was the Notre Dame football game on Saturday.
You could always listen to Notre Dame.
Always listen all the way across. Otherwise, you were always changing stations.
And there was an art to that, right? Somebody sat at the at the AM, right, tuner button, right? And you would hear that, and you hear all of a sudden it crackle like, oh, wait a minute, what is that? And you hear the station identify itself, and hopefully you were moving towards it so you'd have it for a while. But yeah, you drive through most of those areas with nothing to listen to. How did truckers do that? Did they have shortwave radios?
They had shortwave radios, and they talked to each other.
Right. Well, there's a certain amount of the Midwest where there's what are known as, you know, well, it's now a corporation, but they were known as Clear Channel. They were Clear Channel radio stations, and WLW out of Cincinnati was one of them. KMOX in
WLS out of Chicago was another one.
KMOX in St. Louis, and WCW or something in New Orleans, and those things were like blowtorches and KFI in Southern California is another one, but they were huge signals designed for people, you know, on the AM band that were
had 100,000 watt stations. I remember listening to Wolfman would come on after nighttime once it got dark, because he was out of the Southern California or Mexico, and 100,000 watt station, and you'd hear that. Oh, baby, this is the Wolfman talking. Yeah, God, I love that shit. That was fun. But did you ever play the game Mail Pouch?
No.
It was a chewing tobacco that was painted on the side of barns in the East Coast, and they were painted black
as
Mail Pouch.
As advertisers, right?
Advertisement. And we would play Mail Pouch, and you'd...
Wait a minute. Why did you call it Mail Pouch? Because there's no chewing tobacco.
That's the name of the chewing tobacco.
The chewing tobacco?
Mail Pouch.
Are you kidding me? I'm a chewing tobacco specialist. I wanted to chew leaf chewing tobacco as a kid so bad, because all the baseball players I saw play, I mean, they all chewed tobacco. And watching them spit tobacco juice, I thought was the coolest thing in the world.
Well, I got cured of that.
Yeah, so did
We're all playing Little League ball.
Oh my God! Here it is. I'm looking at a
picture. Somebody brought what?
I'm looking at a picture of a barn that says "Chew Mail Pouch Tobacco."
Yes, and then you take a chance. You say, I got the one on the other side. Which was another point. If they were black mail pouch barns, it was 1 point a mail pouch. If it was red mail pouch painted barn, it was 5 points. And so we'd play that game while we were driving, play mail pouch. My brother and I and my sisters.
That's funny. I'm looking at here's a red mail pouch barn. So I guess the mail pouch people would come and paint their advertisement.
Local, they'd paint your barn as long as they could put the advertisement on the end. Hopefully both sides, so they saw him coming and going.
Right. Well, I'm sure depending on there
are. It was all 2-lane highways back then, Mac, as you know.
And so that's when you were a kid growing up in Hagerstown?
Yeah. No, Hamilton.
In Ohio.
And going over to Indianapolis and driving
back. Well,
hold on.
So you moved to Ohio after your dad passed away?
Yes, my mom remarried and moved to Ohio.
Okay.
Right. I'm gonna send you a picture of my mom and my stepdad.
You said Kim outed himself for being a Richie Rich about a week ago. He sent me a picture of what, your grandmother and your grandfather?
Yeah, yeah.
Describe the picture to everybody. It's a hoot.
Well, they're standing in a room that I called the Nubbin, and it was a guest bedroom. It was on the ground floor of this 17th century Dutch farmhouse that they remodeled. And he was an interior designer, and she was a food editor for Ladies' Home Journal. And they're leaning against the fireplace, and they're dressed to the nines, and they both have cigarette holders with cigarettes in them. And Mac and I were talking about it last week, and I looked those pictures up and sent them to him, and he started giving me a hard time.
Oh, man.
About being a blue blood.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I didn't know you were a Richie Rich.
I wasn't. You knew I was the troublemaker.
Well, no, what he
I
said.
I was always.
What Kim said was, I've hit it pretty well all these years, right? His true lineage.
Yeah, I did.
Let me read you. Clear Channel Station is an AM radio in North America that has the highest protection from interference from other stations, particularly concerning nighttime sky wave propagation. The system exists to ensure the viability of cross-country or cross-continent radio service and is enforced through a series of treaties and statutory laws. Known as Class A stations since 1982, they are occasionally still referred to by their former classification as 1A highest classification, 1B next highest, or 1N for stations in Alaska too far away to cause interference to the primary clear channel stations in the lower 48. The term clear channel is used most often in the context of North American and the Caribbean. Since 1941, these stations have been required to maintain at least 10,000 watts of power to retain their status. Nearly all of the stations in the United States and the Bahamas broadcast at 50,000 watts, with several clear channel stations in Mexico going as high as 150,000 watts, and XEW in Mexico City operating at 250,000 watts for over 80 years.
Wow.
How about
holy
that?
Moly.
Is there a list of kilowatts? Let's see. Ones we would know. 50,000 watts. WSW out of Nashville. WFAN out of New York City. Out of Chicago. WSCR. Never heard of it. Out of San Francisco, you've heard of this. KNBR.
KNBR, yeah.
Yeah.
Rest the Moose Syracuse was the disc jockey when I lived in Palo Alto.
And it used to be known as the Mighty 690 out of Baja, California, but you can hear that thing forever. WLW we talked about out of Cincinnati. KIRO out of Seattle. WOR. Now, these are now, most people would recognize them as...
WOR is New York.
Right, is the station that the Mets are on. But most of these stations are now recognized as TV stations. But they got their start as big, clear channel, regional broadcasters that were part of the system across the country that you could listen to, and in particular at night when the radio waves, you know, bounce better. WR in New York City, WGN in Chicago, let's see, WSW in Atlanta, WJR in Detroit, or Detroit, however you pronounce it.
Detroit.
WABC in New York City. Let's see. KGO in San Francisco. WCCO in Minneapolis, St. Paul. KOA in Denver. WWL in New Orleans. WCBS in New York City. WLS in Chicago. And KOMO in Seattle. I used to be able to get KOMO in Sacramento.
Really?
Yeah. KDKA in Pittsburgh, WBZ in Boston, which is a pretty famous station, KNX we talked about in Los Angeles, WTAM in Cleveland, KMOX in St. Louis. Let me see, KSL in Salt Lake City, and so there's. But that was how before there was any, you know, thing that you could play in your car. I remember us talking about, we had a little reel-to-reel recorder, and thinking, this is before cassettes. Well, could we record music and play it in the car when we can't hear anything? Well, yeah, we can try. And then you had to have enough battery power to do that stuff and whatnot. So long before the days of
satellite radio,
exactly,
and electric windows,
exactly. The
and air conditioning.
So driving across the country. Is there a favorite stretch? Here's an email. Mac, do either one of you have a favorite stretch relative to driving? Kim, do you have a favorite drive that you've made in the country?
Yes. I think probably the one I've done the most is from San Francisco down to Big Sur on Highway 1. And it goes through Santa Cruz and Monterey, where Pebble Beach is. And ends up in Big Sur National Park, and that's a one of my very favorite drives. It's a lot of twists and turns, but that whole coast of from Astoria, Oregon, before you cross the bridge into Washington State, all the way down to San Diego on Highway 1. It's probably one of the prettiest drives. And you have to do it not on the weekends. You have to do it midweek.
Well, and let me tell you, Kim,
pretty traveled road.
People want to let's drive down the coast. First of all, it takes days to do that. It is not slow. It is not fast driving, and the coast highway winds, and it's pretty intense driving, and so it's not like driving down I-5 where you can like rest your thigh against the steering wheel and look out the window. It ain't like that.
Have it on cruise control going 90.
Yeah, you can't. You're going between 35 and 55, and your foot is on and off the gas pedal. And it is pay attention driving, because it's because of the curves and the windiness. Now, it is no doubt it's a beautiful drive, but it ain't like you don't got to pay attention when you drive kind of style that I think we're used to in other parts of the country. I'll tell you what I think what's become my favorite drive, and that is the drive on Interstate 10. As you get into northern Arizona and northern New Mexico, not so much western Texas, but it does get pretty in the westernmost part of Texas. But it is northern New Mexico and northern Arizona. We're talking Grand Country, you know, region. It's beautiful. It is absolutely.
It is magnificent. And when you get in New Mexico and you're up going on the interstate, I think it's 40 up there near Santa Fe, Interstate 40. You take a left and 25 starts up the eastern slope of the Rockies to Colorado Springs and Denver and on up to Boulder. There are some beautiful drives. I took Beth one time, to Santa Fe for her birthday. I think it was her 50th birthday.
Yes.
And we left Santa Fe and drove straight north, didn't take interstates at all, and drove right up, through northern, through Taos, New Mexico.
Oh, man.
And all the way up through this valley, and we're driving at about 7,000-8,000 feet with the mountains still going up on both sides,
right,
in Colorado. And then we took that all the way up and then, to Interstate 70 and then came down into, along the Continental Divide and then went down into Denver on our way home. And then, drove through Denver,
just think about that drive though, from Santa Fe and
yes,
into place that, you know, for Native American tribes, I mean, northern New Mexico, there's many high spiritual places and much of it has to do with simply the geography and the spiritual place that it takes you when you see it. And, very much like the Badlands, right? Very much like the Badlands in South Dakota. I mean, it's beautiful. I'll tell you another beautiful drive is 94, through not so much North Dakota, because North Dakota is flat, but when you get into the western Montana, and Montana's spectacular, and then through
all
Idaho,
of Montana,
yeah,
is.
And then you know it's the region of Yellowstone Park, right? So it is.
Yes,
that's another beautiful. If you've never driven that, that's another beautiful drive. I need to, before I leave the planet, I need to do one of those trips where you rent a motorhome and you just kind of cruise around the country for a couple months. And start out here and drive 8 and go to baseball games and do things along, go to museums. You know, I've never been to the D-Day Museum in New Orleans. I'd love to go there. You know, just kind of drive the country. I could do my show for most of these places as long as I had an internet connection. Not since I've thinking about it. No, and just do it at a leisurely pace, not really having a timeline. So it's such a fun experience. And let me just tell you, the people that you meet along the way, I met these people getting gas, driving my sister's stuff out here from Indianapolis. I flew back, I loaded a truck, and I left that night. And I drove 2 straight days, and I was in Nebraska. And I thought I was going to run out of gas, but I didn't, thankfully. And I pull into this gas station and run by a family. And I walked in, and I don't know what T-shirt I was wearing, but it said something about the Marine Corps. And she said, "Oh, were you a Marine?" And I said, "Yeah, I was." And she said, "Well, God bless you." And she just starts talking. I said, do you own this place?" And she said, "Yep. Me and my brother own it. Got it from our dad." And I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Do you run it?" She said, "Well, my brother does, and I just kind of come and help him out." I said, "Well, where is he today?" She said, "He's not in here yet." And, but you know, it's just, right? Then you just, you know, you have a conversation, and, you've been driving, you're stretching your legs a little bit, and you just meet the nicest people, and it was Saturday morning, so the Nebraska football team, which used to be really good and has struggled the last few years, maybe the last decade, but there's
Big Red.
And in states like North Dakota, in states like Nebraska, in states like Alabama and Iowa, right, that don't have any professional teams, these are the professional teams. When
the college teams are.
When Nebraska plays, right, the whole state goes red. And so
yes.
And so they were, she had a red sweatshirt on. She was all fired up about it. And I said, well, you know, probably not going to turn out very well today. And she says, oh, no, we're going to win. I said, oh, really? She says, we're Cornhuskers. We can do it. And I said, all right, good luck with that. But, you know, you just meet these wonderful people who are very cool, very cool. And especially seeing the way you hear Kim talk about seeing it, you know, either hitchhiking or driving, you know, going through diners and through small towns. It's not the way we really do it anymore. It's, right, it's interstates with hotels at major interchanges and fast food places.
Yep.
And so the ambiance of the trip, a lot of it has been stripped away. So, for the better.
You can find
right.
Even going on the interstates, you get off, and when you go to the hotel or check into your hotel motel, ask where they eat that's not a fast food joint.
Right.
And they can usually turn you on to some pretty great joints. Now, folks, I'm going to tell you about a place.
Oh, man, here we go.
And I've seen it on Diners and Drive-Ins. Buff Goldman, the baker from Baltimore, on the Food Channel. And I'm going to go there. Now, it's on U.S. 60. It's a two-lane. You take Interstate 25 down from Albuquerque. If you're going, and then you hit 60. And then you go west on New Mexico towards Arizona. And just before you get to Arizona, about maybe 30, 40 miles before you're into Arizona, is a place called Pie Town. P-I-E-T-O-W-N. And there's this place that all they do is serve pies. And so...
Pie Town.
If you're ever at Pie Town. And 60 goes, it's a truck from Albuquerque to Phoenix. But it dumps you out in Mesa, in southern Phoenix. But from everything I've read and seen on TV, it's one of my places I want to stop. When I go to Phoenix, I'll drive east, I guess, unless I can drive west, and then I'd go south off of 40 and then go down towards Mexico and then turn off on 60 about halfway through New Mexico down south, about an hour and a half south of Albuquerque, I think it is. Yeah. This country is just full of gems.
They're cool.
And if you get a chance to hit the highway, you have to do it. Pack up your family or just you and your significant other and hit the bricks. I never call up and make reservations. I have no idea because I have to stop and pee about every 2 hours. So, I'm on pee time, and so I'll be cruising along. I say, "Well, we're about an hour and a half," and I'll call my I have OnStar in my car, and I dial it in, and say, hey, "American Express, get me I need a hotel room. I don't want to spend more than $100, senior rate," and they always come in between $95 and $115. For the night.
Wow.
And I, you know, I pull in and get a reservation, or I just get lucky.
You just pull in and see if somebody has a room.
Yeah.
That's the way it used to be, right? Or, and I remember Kathleen did this once. Back in the day, right, you would go down to remember all the AAA offices all over the country?
Yep.
AAA was you went in and you planned your trip. And AAA... right? They
did a triptych. They call it a triptych.
They would make your hotel reservations. They would give you the map. They would give you the maps. They would highlight your route. And I remember because Kathleen came home with one of these packages when I can't remember where we went. Probably to Alabama one of the last times because I'm old enough to remember it. But there was like a packet and it had every map we needed. And I used to be the navigator. Right? I used to be the navigator and I would.
My parents did that too. That is funny stuff.
Remember that? But that's how you did it.
They'll still do it today if you want.
Right, right. You know. But, you know, obviously you can get on, you know, the internet and you can plan your own trip. But it's every stop along the way where you're going to eat, where you're going to spend the night and all the rest of that stuff. But back in the day, unless you did that with AAA, right? You pulled into a town and you went to the hotels and do you have a room?
Yeah. You know any place that has a room? And they'll call it up.
Yeah, they would call around. They would call around like, well, we don't, but.
Yeah, we don't. Yeah, that's the answer.
The Super 8 does. And there was no smoking, non-smoking rooms, right? You got a room.
Yeah.
And now, in just one of my latest speaking events where I was on the East Coast, right, I can't even be near a room that has that smells like smoke. And so I grew up with it in my house. And they told me it wasn't a smoking room. I got in it and I said, I can't do this. And I'm not normally somebody who goes and bitches about stuff, but I went back to the front desk and I said, hey, you told me that's a non-smoking room. It smells like smoke. Well, it might just be because I said, no, I've opened the windows, right? And I went down there about an hour after I'd been in the room. And I said, and I don't know what's, either somebody smoked in there. She said, well, it might be the ventilation. We have a single ventilation system and sometimes right? And she said, hold on one second. And she was very nice to me and gave me another room. And, but you know, back in the day, there was none of that, man. If the person that had that room yesterday smoked, then you were smoking too. And so, anyway, so the way we used to travel, right, around the country. So, pretty cool. Back when life went a little bit slower. But now, you know, right, you get on the interstate, it's going to take us X number of hours, we're going to get there, we'll be at this hotel, we're going to do this, 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 and this. And we don't stop and hang out like we used to.
Yeah.
I still do, though. That's the business of retirees and hippies, man.
Yeah.
Or retired hippies.
Well, or retired hippies. Some things never change, Mac.
There you go. I got a question for you. Mac, can I ask a food question? Of course, you can always. We got sidetracked talking about traveling. Could the chef give me some cooking instructions? And then in parentheses, I do have a digital thermometer for my leg of lamb that I will grill. So grilling a leg of lamb, wow, that's we never really kind of talked about that. So how would you season it?
Okay, start it. You sear it on the all the way around on high heat. And
so this is on the grill. So this is on the grill on the charcoal side.
On the charcoal side or the gas side, that's all the way high.
Right.
And then you brown it and get your grill marks on there. And then before you switch it to the cool side, you turn those burners totally off on the cool side.
Right.
You start it all out where all the burners are on high.
Right.
Okay? When you put that leg of lamb on the high side, you turn the other burners off because we're going to use indirect heat. And you brown it a couple of minutes all the way around. Should be probably four turns if it's a bone-in leg. Or if it's a boneless leg of lamb, I suspect it's a bone in.
Right.
And then you put it in indirect heat and put your thermostat in, and you want to go into the deepest part, the fattest part of the meat, and you want it to read for rare 120 for rare.
Okay.
And a leg of lamb, because it, you know, there's that thermostat will be inside that lamb. The outside is going to be medium to medium. Well, it'll be medium well to medium rare to rare at 120 in the center. And most of it will be medium rare. But don't forget that when you take that off the grill and say you want a medium rare, which will be about 130, you take it off at 125, cover it, and leave it to rest for about at least 10 minutes, and it'll go up. The internal temperature will go up to 130, and you have your perfect medium rare.
Awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, a digital thermometer makes it pretty easy.
Oh, right?
So again, essentially the same process: sear it, move it to indirect heat, and then let it slow cook.
Yeah.
And it's that slow cooking with the seasoning that you put on it is what makes it absolutely tender and full of flavor. So there you have it.
Yeah.
Leg of lamb on the grill. All right, my friend. Any big
now, any now big... next week, everybody, we have to talk 4th of July, because 4th of July is 2 weeks from yesterday. So next Friday is going to be the last time we'll go through our 4th of July routine and all that stuff that we always do. But if you have any specific questions about grilling, please call in, and so we can talk turkey.
Talk steak. Talk hot dogs. Talk weenies. Talk all of it. All right.
Hamburgers, brats, all of the above.
Potato salads.
Stuff like that.
All right, there you have it. The chef on a Friday.
Thank you very much, everyone.
All right, the retired hippie in motion, talking about adventures on the road of life today. So, Kim, thanks for the visit. Have a great weekend.
Highway of life.
There you go, baby. Have a great one.
You too, brother.
There you have it. Paul Kimball Holmes here on a Friday. One of the guys I like to listen to, because he's a smart guy, is a guy named Jack Keane. And he was on Fox News here recently. And again, I for those of you that are just joining us late, If you wait for the first hour, Jeff Kenny, Tim Lynch join me in the first hour. And we recorded it last night because they have jobs and stuff that they do. But I want to listen to Jack Keane. But we essentially said, look, obviously the problem is Iran and nuclear weapons, right? On the far side of that problem is Israel that will not allow it. And they're not going to talk to anybody. They will, through intercontinental ballistic missiles and through, you know, their own F-35s, they will annihilate the capability that Iran has. Make no mistake about that, because Israel will not play that game. And then that will light off a war in the Middle East, like the likes of which we haven't seen yet, and we will be a part of it. So know that that's on the far side of this. Okay, so it's not the open-ended event that going sideways is in the Western Pacific, right? Israel's out there, and Israel will not allow that. So the sanctions are obviously hurting. So Iran has created these events, right, as noisemakers. And I'll just give you an example. If you want to sink a ship with a limpet mine, okay, you don't put it halfway up the hull of the ship. You put it below the waterline, where it will do the damage that it's supposed to do. Water will be ingested into the ship, and the ship will sink. That's how mines work. That's what they do. Putting it up the halfway up the ship is only good if you want videotape to show the world that we did something. Okay? It's not good for sinking the ship. So Iran is creating made-for-TV events that are designed for America's center of gravity. And that center of gravity is like it was in Vietnam. Our television sets that go in to American living rooms and affect American public opinion. Iran knows that. So what you're watching is a made-for-TV event. So in our discussions that you'll hear coming up right after this, you'll hear Kim, you'll hear Jeff and Tim and I essentially come to a consensus that the most beneficial course of action for the United States is restraint and to begin to conduct cyber operations against Iran. All right, so we're not going to do anything kinetic that hurts anybody because that feeds into their narrative of America, right, abusing us and this is why we're the victim in all this. So then the other thing we have to do is protect ourselves because Iran, over the course of our historical relationship with them, if they've done one thing extremely well is they've operated outside the bun. And whether you talk about the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, whether you talk about bombing of the, I believe it was an Air Force barracks at Khobar Towers, whether you talk about their penetrators for the IEDs that they sent to Iran, their advisors that fought in Iran against the United States, all the different things Iran has done around the world that they've never been held accountable for. That's a part of this. So the best thing that we can do is let the sanctions stay in place, restrain our military, and not give Iran what they want. Okay, so you'll hear that discussion here in the next hour if you hang with us. But I want to hear General Jack Keane because I enjoy his measured discussion, and I'm curious what he has to say. He joined Harris Faulkner, who's a military brat. She wrote a book recently. I might have to, like, and they sent it to me for free, meaning that they're normally interested in you having her on. So I'd love to have her on. Anyway, here's Jack Keane talking about.
As one civilian leader said in private national security discussions yesterday, sometimes a show of restraint is a show of force in and of itself. Harris?
See how smart I am?
Thank you very much. I want to bring in now retired four-star General Jack Keane, chairman at the Institute for the Study of War and a Fox News senior strategic analyst. General, thank you for being with me. When the president says, I'm in no hurry, what does that communicate to Iran?
Well, I think clearly the sanctions are beginning to cripple the Iranian economy, and we've laid out the details of what that really means. And he knows that the Iranians are reacting to it, and that's what these provocations have been about these last few weeks. The latest one, of course, the shoot down of an American drone. I think the president clearly believes that time is on his hands, on his side, because of what the sanctions are doing to the Iranians. And the provocations themselves, I think what I see happening in the future here, in the near term, is the administration is going to shore up the shipping lanes in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. I think that's a task that Secretary Pompeo has been heavily involved in. It'll mm-hmm. be a coalition effort with allies in the region and possibly some allies from outside the region and the United States to make certain that flow of oil out of that artery in the Persian Gulf is able to maintain itself. And the United States has a national interest here. Even though we're not dependent on oil the way we used to be, we are have an interest in a stable and secure Middle East in terms of the fact that half of the world's economy is dependent on that. So that is our national interest there. And
interesting.
That's going to be a major task in front of us. The second major task in front of us is the Iranian threat, Harris, to, again, they're trying to leverage the international community against the United States by threatening moving from the JCPOA, the nuclear deal restriction on uranium enrichment, which is 3.67%, and move to a number that they're using, 20%. That is alarming because from that 20%, you can go very quickly to weaponization in terms of enriched uranium. That's a number that's got everybody's attention. Clearly, the Israelis has got the attention of the United States national security team here. And I would imagine that the United States, without equivocation, will be going back to the Iranians publicly and privately,
right,
and telling them this is likely going to be a red line for us.
I want to step in with this because, as we know, the president has given a recent interview with NBC, and I want to know the importance of him saying this, that he never gave final warning. Planes would have been in the air pretty soon, and he didn't think the airstrike was proportionate to the drone attack. What is the significance of the president giving that level of detail about why we aren't hitting that military target? The means, as you told me about this week, yesterday as the story was breaking, not hitting the means that took down our drone.
Yeah, well, they were clearly going after the means, from what I understand, batteries, radar sites and command and control that take care of those. And they estimated of 150 casualties. I think what he was going through in his mind was, you know, an unmanned drone versus 150 casualties as a trade-off. It didn't sit right with him. He's the commander-in-chief, and he's the decision-maker, and I think it's pretty typical of this president. He tells you what he thinks. You know, he puts it right on his sleeve there. So I take that at face value from him. I do know from talking to people, and this is somewhat in dispute here, but from talking to people who were at the earlier briefings in the day when the options were discussed, these casualty numbers were not supposedly presented at that time. They were presented much later, you know, prior to the strike. That's in dispute, obviously, from what Jennifer was saying.
Right. I want to get this in real quickly before I have to let you go. Was this a cancellation or a delay?
I think based on this reality, it's a cancellation. I don't see a re-attack unless the Iranians do something in addition to what they've done. And if they start taking American lives, and with Qasem Soleimani in charge here, that eventually is likely. And then you're going to see a different kind of strike entirely if Americans are killed by the Iranians.
Let's
but
hope that doesn't
this
happen.
Strike, I think, is on the shelf and it's likely not going to be redone.
All right, there you have it, Jack Keane. And see how smart we are? Yeah, how about that? Again, the goal is to win the issue, right? Is to do what's in your national interest. And, you know, And sometimes playing tit for tat. First of all, playing tit for tat is never the game, right? They play tit and you play tat disproportionately, like the Israelis play tit for tat. So nobody wants to go there with you. So that's the whole art of, I think, being a superpower. And when it goes there, you have to make the consequences so that everybody sees and says, "Yeah, I wouldn't have done that." Right. But let me just tell you, the Iranians have played this better than anybody. They played this game of flicking the nose of the United States, right? Standing in the spotlight that affords one, and then never, ever, ever having consequences. Right? Right? The economic consequences they deal with. They attempt to. And that's what this is all about. And the economic consequences are beginning to evidently affect the ultimate base of the Iranian government. And that is smaller towns, more fundamentalist people are not so much about it anymore. They're tired of the way they live. And so the Iranians desperately need economic relief, and this whole thing is designed to put Europeans, right, in a vice. You can either preserve your lines of business that have opened up since President Obama dropped the sanctions, the billions of dollars that that has created, and you can go ahead and do that. Or it can that can all go by the wayside. So that's the vice that they've created. Interesting. All right. That'll do it on a Friday. Don't touch that dial because you're going to hear kind of a special edition of Jeff and Tim and I doing three things. One, identify what is the problem here. Okay. Two, our history, which is important to understand the way we've done this dance with Iran for decades. And that we have to deliver a better message so that we tell them that we're not going to dance that dance anymore. Okay? If you go down these roads, we're going to make it hurt for you in a way that we haven't made it hurt for you yet. And so you've got to stop. So we talk about the history a little bit, and then the next question is, so going forward, what would you do? What would you do? And you haven't heard it yet, but one of the things that I would do is I would introduce offensive cyber operations into the equation. And I would stop restraining our cyber community, and I would let the Iranians know that if you want to go down this road, we can go down it in a way that you really don't want to go down. So, there you have it. On a Friday, have a great weekend. All Marine Radio, over and out.